The Late Set is supported by WRTI members and the Kate May Jazz Festival Foundation, presenting the 25th edition of the Exit Zero Jazz Festival, November 7th through 9th. See bassist Stanley Clark, vocalist Gabrielle Cavassa, and the iconic Cassandra Wilson, presenting the 30th anniversary of her album, New Moon Daughter. Those artists and so many more at the Exit Zero Jazz Festival in Cape May, New Jersey, this November 7th through 9th. Learn more at ExitZeroJazzFestival.com. Now, here's the Late Set.
Welcome to The Late Set. This is Nate Chenin. Hope you're having a good summer. We just heard a little bit of music from the new album by Joshua Redman. It's the title track, Words Fall Short. Really beautiful quartet album on Blue Note Records. Features, among others, Philadelphia's own Nazir Ebo on drums. And the reason that we heard that track is that we have dipped into the Late Set archives for you today. If you started listening to this show recently, you may not have heard some of the great episodes that came towards the start of this journey. The Late Set's been around for almost 2 years, and today I thought we'd bring you a really special conversation from almost the very beginning. This is our second episode, which featured Joshua Redman. We took the occasion to talk with Josh about his experience in competition. I had just come back from New York covering the Herbie Hancock International Jazz Piano Competition. And so I had, the idea of jazz competitions on my mind. So we talked to Joshua Redman about his experience at what was then the Monk Competition and the way that it launched his career, some of the, the complications around it, the ways in which, he felt it was both a boost and also a bit of a challenge for him at the start of his career. So in just a few moments, you will hear that conversation. It features the original Late Set team, myself and Greg Bryant, and I think you'll really enjoy it. Before we dive in, just a little bit of forward promoting. Our next episode will be back to all new material. I'll be joined by Josh Jackson, and we've got a fun conversation about the Village Vanguard, specifically recordings made at the Vanguard, some of our favorites, some of the behind-the-scenes details on what it takes to capture sound in that legendary room, and we're going to be trying to stump each other, so you will not want to miss that. And now, without any further ado, here is Joshua Redman with myself and Greg Bryant on The Late Set. Joshua, thank you so much for joining us on The Late Set. What a pleasure to have you. We are in competition season. The Hancock Competition just concluded, formerly known, of course, as the Thelonious Monk Competition. And you've got some history with this event.
Yeah, just some slight history, minor history.
Yeah, a little bit. And I thought, who better but you to give us a little perspective on the ins and outs of competition. So I guess I wanted to start by setting the scene. 1991, November, and you go down to DC and take part in the Monk Competition, and you end up taking first place, and it was like the shot heard around the world, mm-hmm. And so I wondered if you could sort of bring us back there. What was that experience like for you? What was going through your head as you went through it?
Sure. Well, in a way, you're bringing me back there. I haven't been trying to run away from it, but it is it's far in the rearview mirror right now. But I think I'm at that stage in life where You know, I can I can confront more easily some things that maybe I feel like I've been running from earlier in life. 1991, I had graduated college in June of 91, and I ended up moving to New York as a kind of last minute whim almost. I decided I wanted to take a year off. I was on my way to law school, I thought. But but it was, yeah, it was like maybe a couple months before I graduated that I found out that there was a place with a bunch of incredible musicians, friends of mine whom I had met in Boston, many musicians whom you know. They had a space in the house there, and it basically was the living room. So I moved down to New York and was living with them, and that was June of 91. And very quickly, I kind of became immersed in the music scene in New York and started playing a lot, started gigging around town with my peers, started getting to work with some of my peers and also some older musicians, including my father. He hired me to start playing with him. I was just super lucky. You know, I was just in the right places at the right time and, you know, around the right folks. And I was able to, you know, within a few months of being in New York, I was able to kind of support myself playing the music that I love to play with, the musicians I love to play it with. As far as the Monk competition, so yes, I mean, I was vaguely aware that it was saxophone that year. And maybe, you know, for quite some time, I think it had been just piano. And then maybe the year before was the first year that they made it a non-piano competition. I think it was a trumpet competition. The saxophone number was called, you know? Yeah. And I got the tape in, and I think it was like a few days late, and I should have been disqualified, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, and then I was accepted, obviously, to the semifinals. And then, I mean, it's kind of a blur. I mean, I mean, like, that year was just, I mean, every year, like, every year is incredible, but it was so stacked.
So you came in first, Eric Alexander came in second, and third place was shared by Chris Potter and Tim Warfield.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's kind of a murderer's row of saxophone talent from your generation.
I mean, I was definitely murdered. I don't know what happened. I swear to God, I did not bribe anyone, Nate, Greg. I did not. You know, whatever. I'm not going to tell you who I thought should have won, but it wasn't me. Let's put it that way. It wasn't me.
Well, we think about competition, and there's another C word, camaraderie, that I want to bring up. You know, being a tenor saxophonist, you know, historically, we think about Lockjaw and Griffin and Ammons and Stitt and even Sonny and Coltrane. Yeah, there may have been a little bit of friendly fire, but there was a brotherhood, if you will, surrounding that tenor saxophone. Any memories of friendships that you made or memorable exchanges being in the midst of your peers, as you mentioned, Eric Alexander and Chris Potter and so forth?
I mean, yeah, I know this sounds totally basic and cliche, but it's all love, you know, it really is. Like, the jazz community is, from my experience, I mean, not across the board, but among those who are really serious and can really play, I feel like there's so much camaraderie, as you say, and warmth and support and empathy and humility. And I mean, I certainly felt that. I mean, I've always felt that as a jazz musician. You know, I mean, there are a few exceptions to that rule, which will remain unnameable, at least for my lips right now. You know, there are a few of my my peers where maybe I haven't felt that way. But that's cool. You know, look, I guess this idea of competition is somehow baked in to jazz culture, or maybe more so jazz myth, you know, the jazz lore. This idea of the cutting session, and in particular the tenor battle. And, you know, we're aware of this, you know, Lockjaw and Griffin. I mean, back in the day, you know, there's the story of, like, you know, Coleman Hawkins coming down to Kansas City and Lester Young basically like holding court there. And, you know, I mean, we've got, you know, and Sonny and Nuke and Train on Tenor Madness. I mean, you know, it's there. I mean, but can we really get in the mind of those musicians, like at the time, how competitive really were they? How much of this is something that is constructed by the storytellers who weren't necessarily the musicians, you know?
Yeah.
It's fine. You know, I mean, look, I'm not saying competition has no place in the music. I can say that it's not a spirit with which I approach music. You know, I camaraderie, yes, but more, even more so collaboration, you know? I mean, even if I'm playing with, and conversation, like if I'm playing with another saxophone player, like it's another tenor player, even if it's billed as a tenor battle, like my goal is not to like cut the other person, you know, or to try to, you know, come out on top. All my best ideas come from other musicians. You know, I used to think I was naked without external musical input. So like, if I'm playing with someone else, I'm inspired by them and trying to have a dialogue with them. That's true in every situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, it can't be true in a situation where you've got a line of individual saxophone players coming up to bat, right? You know,
right.
It's like, I mean, I can't have a conversation with Eric Alexander or Chris Potter if I'm not playing with them. But I feel like the spirit was just full of love and friendship and support. And, you know, I mean, we choose this music, or this music chooses us, because we fall in love with it. We're not enamored with our own sounds and our own capabilities and our own prowess. You know, it's a music. Yeah. It's a gift for us. And I think most of my favorite jazz musicians approach it with that sense of gratitude and humility and camaraderie.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you say that the music chooses us, I can't help but feel that there is a kind of destiny in the story you're telling, because it just so happens that the saxophone competition falls during this summer when you are taking this gap year and like, you know, woodshedding in a house full of musicians.
Yeah.
And the outcome of this competition was really pretty amazing, right? Because legendarily, you know, after you win the competition, there's literally a bidding war from record labels.
Yeah.
Just the interest in your musicianship and also, as you say, like the story around you too, right? Mm-hmm. And the person who ends up winning this bidding war is Matt Pearson, who goes on to produce your first records for Warner Brothers.
Yes.
And this is a, you know, it's a really game-changing kind of moment in jazz culture. I remember being in high school, engrossed by the whole story, you know, and like, oh my God, like, wow. So, I mean, what was that like for you, being the sort of the belle of the ball?
Yeah. I mean, it was a trip. So, and it's a trip I'm still on, I guess, you know. Yeah, I mean, you know, like destiny, I mean, I'm not sure I believe in destiny. I also am not sure I believe in free will, but that's a subject for another podcast, you know.
Well, I mean, go ahead. If things had gone a different way in that competition, like, would you have just had fun that summer and then gone to law school? I mean, is that...
I really want to sit here and say, and I feel like I can say with some measure of confidence that the answer would be no, because I mean, I was already playing, as I said before, you know, I'd already done, I've already doing gigs with my dad. I was doing gigs around town with a lot of folks. I'd already done like my first little tour with Jeff Keyser actually hired me. Leon Parker was in that group too. So we did a little tour of the Midwest. So, you know, I was already starting to work. Some older musicians had already started calling. Charlie Hayden had hired me to sub for the Liberation Orchestra. There was a tour with Paul Motion that was going to come up in the spring, and maybe one with Jack DeJohnette. So like, things were starting to happen for me, and I was already falling in love with playing this music, and also just overwhelmed with the realization that I had the opportunity to do it, and in a way to bypass a lot of dues paying that I certainly probably needed to be doing, but that wasn't necessarily what I wanted to be doing, you know? I think I spent a lot of time early on after the competition trying to minimize its importance, not out of any disrespect for the competition, but just because I felt like, you know, obviously it got a lot of attention and it didn't in any way change the way that I thought or felt about my own musical abilities, or more importantly, the lack thereof.
You brought up dues paying earlier, and I sort of have a bit of a flip side question, if you will, if you can indulge me. Do competitions at all maybe even rob the musical community of designating its next heroes? Why or why not?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. I don't think so.
Okay.
Because, in fact, I'm going to say no, because like winning a jazz competition, I don't believe has been proven to be any sort of guaranteed recipe for success, you know, either for, I mean, commercial success in jazz is almost an oxymoron, right? But either for success, either for success career-wise, or for the ultimate success, which is artistic success and the respect and admiration and acceptance of your musical community. For the most part, I think most of the competition winners, and I'm not, you know, I don't keep score. You all probably do a better job than I do with that. But most of them can play and are good musicians. But I mean, the list of truly game-changing jazz musicians who have not won, some not even been accepted to like the semifinal round of some of these competitions, is pretty, you cannot dismiss that,
right?
Put it that way. I mean, I don't want to name names, I say, you know, but I, you know, there are quite a few, okay, who have gone on, who haven't placed highly or even, you know, been recognized by the competition, and yet are the absolute heroes of this music, and the guiding lights, and the game changers, and the paradigm shifters. So I think it's another, I mean, it was a tremendous honor for me to be able to be there, and obviously, you know, a huge surprise and yeah, a gift to have been recognized there. But it's, you know, it's a feather in the cap. Maybe it's a little tool in the career toolbox, but I think the musical community ultimately, you know, and when I say the community, I mean the community of artists and the community of listeners and the community of journalists and of observers, like that community will choose its heroes, and the narrative will unfold organically and naturally and from the heart of this music. I don't think the competitions, I don't think that they're paradigm shifters.
Yeah.
I think what they can do is, in certain cases, musicians that are already, for whatever reason, poised to capture a cultural moment or the imagination of the community. If they do place well in the competition, if they do win, that can be, you know, fuel for the fire.
For me, as a listener and as a critic, certainly, you know, competitions have a certain utility.
Utility, that's the word.
Yeah, because they do kind of identify people who have a certain like ability to rise to the occasion, right?
Right.
And sail through the obstacle course.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool when it happens and it works, right?
But I think a great thing is that you're putting the spotlight on the generation behind you. And sometimes I worry, just as a listener, that maybe even competitions have helped us to be a bit more complacent about finding the next talent or searching the next, you know, who's who on his or her or their instrument. The music business, of course, is completely different than it was in the 90s. What responsibility, Joshua, do we all have as listeners, as contributors to this community, to keep our ears and eyes critically open to the next voices?
I would be very hesitant to say, oh, a jazz listener or someone who's, you know, loyal to this music has a responsibility to always be looking out for like the next great young voices, you know? I mean, if that's what you're interested in, or if you hear one and they move you, beautiful. But like, if you just want to listen to like, you know, Ben Webster play with strings for like, you know, the next two decades, yeah. I'm all on, yeah. I'm on board with that, bro. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Like, I'm right with you.
Yeah, you know? It's tough. And you know, like for me, I want to hear what's out there now. I'm hugely influenced by and inspired by my peers. And now as I age by younger musicians. So it's kind of something that's always been part of my honest, natural, leanings and desires. Like that's natural to me. But like maybe some of my greatest heroes don't have that, you know? I mean, who knows? Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think of someone like Keith Jarrett, okay?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Is Keith Jarrett, was he out there, you know, checking, like, you know, reading, yeah, you know, checking, true. Like, you know, going, he wasn't going down the Smalls, right? You know? Like, sure, like, you sure. know, I mean, you know, and, you know, this is one of the greatest artists and musicians of our time in any genre, right? So,
that's right.
You just gotta be, you gotta, again, a cliche, but I think it's about being true and natural to yourself.
Well, that raises an interesting question, though, because, you know, I have served on a competition jury, and Joshua, you served on the Monk competition jury in 96 and again in 2002. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could shed light on what that experience was like, you know, bringing the kind of, you know, adjudication mindset to what you understand to be not a quantitative kind of art.
Absolutely. The antithesis of that.
Like, so what was it like putting on that hat and sitting in that room around that table?
Well, you know, the hat didn't fit so well, you know, especially, I mean, I actually have that problem actually, low key, like I can't actually find a baseball cap that fits me. It's like when I find one, I just buy it because I know it'll be another 3 years, you know? Wow. I mean, it was deep. Like, I remember the first, the first year, it was like, I don't even remember who that, I think it was maybe Jackie Mack was there. I mean, some of the folks who were the judges when I won in 91, maybe Jimmy Heath was also there again. I know that Joe Lovano was there. This was when I judged in 95.
Yeah.
But here it is, and I won't go into the details, but like at one point, you know, you're sitting around a table and talking about these musicians. And at one point, I realized that I was arguing with Wayne Shorter. And I was just like, what the F are you, you know, like, like, you know, I wasn't, I mean, I was, you know, but we had a difference of opinion,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And so I felt like, well, it's my responsibility to at least like voice what my opinion is. That's what, and then I just was like, wait, this is so absurd. You know, like, this is like my all time, you know, greatest composer in jazz, you know, greatest voice, most poetic, you know, most ethereal. So like, it was weird.
Yeah.
It was weird. I think the second time around, I was more prepared for it. And maybe Wayne wasn't a judge that year, so it was a little easier. No, he was.
Yeah, well, I wasn't ever in a room when Wayne was a judge. But I've been in a room with some other pretty heavy, you know, heavy cats, and
yeah,
and you realize like it really is subjective,
absolutely,
and it is about trying to find a kind of truth in that experience.
It's absolutely subjective. You know, you cannot, obviously, you're there for not only your whatever sort of like expertise or knowledge you have in terms of the language of the music and the practices of the music, but also you have an aesthetic and you have your tastes, and you can't not represent them. You know?
Yeah.
And also you have your, you know, maybe you also have a certain sense of not an agenda about like what this music is or what the values of the music are or what it should be. But, you know, I mean, this you have your stories, you know, we're human beings. We tell that's all we have is the stories we tell ourselves, you know, and the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves and the stories we tell ourselves about the world and that we inhabit.
Yeah.
And so you've got your narratives, possible narratives, and there's no way that you're not in some way trying to reconcile these individual voices that musical voices that you're hearing and being presented with, that you're in some way trying to find some reconciliation between them and some sort of narratives that you might have about the music. So,
You are pretty into running. You've been doing like marathons and half marathons.
Mm. I have. I got bitten by the bug during the pandemic. I must admit. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have some family that's really, you know, into the marathon situation. I know it's if you do it right, it's not something you approach lightly. Mm-hmm. And so since we're talking about competition, what parallels can you draw between, the marathon training and, mm-hmm. and competitive drive mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the sort of what we've been talking about.
Right, right. That's a great question. Yeah. You know, growing up, I was pretty much a lousy competitor. I was a horrible athlete. You know, I had no athletic talent, mm-hmm. you know, and I also did not have a competitive mindset, you know,
I
didn't have the skills and I also didn't have any sort of will to win. You know, mm-hmm. so that's one of the reasons why I felt like, oh, you know, music and maybe in particular jazz music is like, you know, a good fit for me, you know.
Yeah.
I had a certain sort of competitive drive with academics, but it was really, it was always more self-competent, like trying to never being happy with my performance and trying to increase that. And I guess that's true with music as well. I think that, you know, I still consider myself a crappy athlete. I seem to be doing all right for my age in this running thing. I think a lot of that is just, you know, my powers of delayed gratification and my capacity for you know, my slightly masochistic tendencies, you know, could come into, you know, endurance athletics is a very interesting thing because you're not, I mean, unless you're, you know, Eliud Kipchoge or, you know, like, I mean, you know, unless you're like the elites in the pack and you're literally like racing other runners, you know, I mean, like I ran in the Boston Marathon, that's 30,000 runners. I mean, you're running in a sea of runners, but it's like, you're not racing anybody, you know, you're racing yourself,
right,
you know, you have your own sense of like what your capacities are and what they might be. And you're so in that sense, I guess it's not so much unlike music, you know. Ultimately, like my drive with music has been, you know, just this incredible, I mean, I don't want to say self-loathing, but definitely self-criticism. You know, I'm never happy with the way I play. I mm-hmm. love playing, but I'm never satisfied. And I've always, just tried to be okay, you know? And I guess I do feel like having gotten into specifically marathon training, I feel like it's given me a lot of insight into the process of practice because I've never been a good music practicer. Mm-hmm. Like I've always been good at like throwing myself in musical situations and playing, but I never really practiced and I never liked practicing. And I never, for someone who's a relatively dedicated, disciplined person in certain ways, practicing was never something that I had dialed in that respect. But I guess like the pandemic simultaneously, I really started practicing because that was all I could do, mm-hmm. you know, on a regular basis. And when I started running, you know, that's a form of practice too. And, you know, especially when you're marathon training, there's so much of it is, it's just so, it's the long game. It's the really, really long game, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I feel like it has informed my musical practice in some very important ways. I'm not sure if I can articulate exactly what those are yet.
Yeah, that idea of discipline and then like the self improvement, I guess, you know, like mm-hmm. to call it competition is maybe a misnomer because it's really just about pushing yourself toward an incremental improvement, you know,
very, like, very incremental.
Just a little bit better this time.
Yeah.
You know?
And I'll tell you something, like, as the one thing that I've noticed is, you know, as I've aged, the incrementalism of my improvement has shot up dramatically. Does that make sense? Like, it takes longer and longer to reach whatever that next plateau, you know, even if you can call it that. It's just like, you know, there are obviously losses as you age, right? There are physical declines and cognitive declines, you know, I mean, it's just the nature of the brain and the body. But, you know, there are ways in which you're going to continue to improve and get better, but it just takes so long. So much longer.
Yeah.
So I think that the marathon training has probably taught me that sort of patience or kind of reinforced it kind of in parallel.
Well, I mean, yeah, I feel like the parallel I'm hearing is to a musical career. As we talk about these competitions, they're generally, the musical competitions are generally for younger musicians who may be inclined to think of it as a sprint.
Yeah.
And really what you're saying is like, no, man, you know, a life in this music is a marathon. you've got to be prepared for the long haul and, you know, all of the challenges and all of the rewards that come with that longer arc.
That is one of the luxuries of being a jazz musician, you know?
I mean,
it's true of all artists and all musicians and all artists to an extent, but jazz musicians, I think, I mean, history has shown we have the opportunity, I think, to really have long lives and careers in this music, playing at a high level and making interesting, creative, relevant music, I think.
Yeah. No, you're not only saying it, but you're showing it. Joshua, I am so glad that you won that competition.
I am too, Nate.
for all of the reasons that that led you here to this moment.
Absolutely.
Well, Joshua, we wanted to thank you.
Absolutely, man, for being an ambassador in this music for so long. And for showing us that there are people with ingenuity, executive function, and creativity all in one package to bring this music to the people. You've been doing it for a long time. And we take off our hat to you, man. Thank you so much for your continued contribution.
Right on, Greg. Yeah, I'm not sure about the executive function. Yeah, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to speak with both of you. Thank you for everything you do for the music.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. It's hosted by me, Nate Chenin, with Josh Jackson. This episode was co-hosted by Greg Bryant. The show is produced by Alex Arif. Robert Webb is our assistant production manager. Our operations and production manager is Tyler McClure. Associate General Manager for Content and Programming is Josh Jackson. And Bill Johnson is WRTI's General Manager. Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we're cooking up here in Philadelphia and beyond. We'll see you soon.